Well, beloved listeners, our India Now series is exploring how India is hurtling towards the future, yet in some senses remains rooted in the past. 20 years ago, I was sitting with the President of India whilst the BJP were shaking the gates because of a constitutional crisis. The President was probably the most charming person I've ever met in public life. The 10th President, and the first Dalit to hold that high office. Now the country has a president, once again, of the untouchable caste, even though the country's constitution was written by Dalit leader B. Ambedkar. Widespread prejudice against Dalits continue, some of it overt, some of it subtle. Now, for most part, caste remains a taboo subject. It's not spoken of, it's not investigated, it's hardly visible. And yet, of course, it completely colours our understanding of India, with every institution, academic, legislative, judicial, bureaucratic, journalistic, dominated by the upper castes. Now, last year, a newly published memoir, Ants Among Elephants, An Untouchable Family and the Making of Modern India, by Sujatha Kidler, unveiled a whole other side of the subcontinent. Sujatha is an untouchable. Her uncle was a famous revolutionary and poet. Her parents were teachers. Yet she had to leave India in order to be treated as an ordinary human being. Her book has been greeted with well-deserved acclaim. Panchak Mishra, writing in the New York Review of Books, aptly described it as an all-too-rare victory in the never-ending struggle for Dalit freedom. And I am very pleased that Sujatha could join us today from New York City, where she now lives. Welcome to our little wireless program.
Thank you for having me here.
You use the term untouchable to describe yourself. Do you prefer it to Dalit?
Yes, I would like to say untouchables instead of Dalit, because untouchables is a matter of fact word to describe the condition of the people. They're not allowed to touch anything that belongs to the upper caste people. Dalit is a politically correct term that is being used right now, and it is preferred both by liberals and by Dalit, the untouchables themselves.
But you see it as euphemistic. You see it as concealing rather than telling the truth.
Yes.
You were born in a village to parents who were teachers, and you say that nobody told you you were an untouchable. So how did it dawn on you? How did you become aware of caste?
You may believe it or not believe it, but I think that I was only 2 years old when I knew that we were inferior in Indian society. I didn't know it was called caste, but I knew that we were inferior. And as I grew up, around 7 years of age, I came to know that we are called untouchables, and that is why we are inferior.
I think it might be helpful to Australian listeners if we told them a little about the calibrations in the caste system, with Brahmins at the top and untouchables at the bottom, but many subtleties within. Can you describe them for me?
Okay. In order to explain caste, I think the easiest way is to say, if you know American society, there are black people and white people here, and black people face discrimination and oppression and segregation, all that stuff. It's exactly the same, except that we're not differentiated by skin color. In all Indians, irrespective of their caste, they all have the same kind of skin and same kind of features. So caste is like racism, except that it's not based on skin color or any other features. So caste is a hierarchical thing. At the top are Brahmins, and they have the traditional job of priestly duties. And second is Kshatriyas, which is warriors. They used to be kings and generals, military generals, and things like that. And third caste is Baniyas, which is merchant trading caste. And the fourth consists of many different castes, all service castes. For example, potters, goldsmiths, blacksmiths, diggers, and all kinds of service castes come in the fourth division. And the fifth is untouchables. They actually are outcasts. They're not in the caste system. They are outcasts. And untouchables are given the most menial, the filthiest jobs in the society. That is their traditional job. So that's what caste is, briefly.
And of course, Dalits work in abattoirs. They catch rats. They're responsible for the shit in India.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There are 52 different categories of untouchables in my state. There are farm workers, there are leather workers, people who remove dead animals and carcasses, and there are pakis, shit cleaners, and there is even a caste for women that have to be available for caste Hindus at any time for sexual, to provide sex for them without any compensation.
Good heavens above. Now, given that it is not visible in one's appearance, everyone's skin is the same color, how do people know the caste of another?
Yes, that is why a caste system imposes a number of do's and don'ts on untouchables. So with all of these impositions, they're able to tell who's untouchable. First of all, in villages, they're not allowed to live inside a village. They live outside, segregated. They cannot come into the village unless to do work for caste people. And they have a separate kind of way of dressing. They're not allowed to wear fancy clothes. They have to have something around their loins and nothing more. They cannot have the same kind of haircuts that other people have. They cannot own property. They cannot they cannot wear slippers, footwear. And in Maharashtra, there is a place where if they have to walk inside the village, they have to tie a broom to their waist so that when they walk, the broom will automatically, wipe their footprints. And they had to carry a pot around their neck to spit. They cannot even spit in the village. That's how bad it is.
With millions, many millions of Indians moving to the cities, do those distinctions survive or are they rendered invisible?
In village, it's very, cut and dry, if you're an untouchable. But it kind of carries into towns and cities as well. Like if you go and try to rent a place, they will ask you your caste. You cannot lie because, your last name can be an indicator. The way you dress can be an indicator, and your diction is something else. And if they cannot tell, they can find through other people coming from the same region. So all of these things that set them apart makes them, visible to people everywhere. And even in towns and cities, they have segregated colonies for them. It's kind of less in urban areas, but it's very much there.
Sujatha, surely many people seek to hide themselves through conversion to other religions. I understand quite a lot of Dalits convert to Christianity. Did that help them? Were they welcome within Christianity or still subject to prejudice?
During the British time, Western missionaries came to India to proselytize people, but they could not proselytize caste Hindus because caste Hindus were afraid that if they convert into Christianity, they will lose their caste. So the missionaries were left with only untouchables to convert. And untouchables readily agreed to convert, one, because this is a God that says that all are equal in his eyes. Whereas Hinduism says that Brahmin comes from the forehead of the creator and, the arms are where warriors come from, and untouchables, you know, came even, you know, without sanction of the creator. So it's inside the religion itself, the discrimination. So Christianity is sounded very, very egalitarian to them, and it is a very novel idea for them. That's ideological, you know, motive to convert to Christianity. And there are material incentives, such as they were allowed in missionary schools to get education. They were allowed in their hospitals if their children fall sick and things like that. But now, since untouchables mainly converted into Christianity, so if you are a Christian, it's more or less, it means that you are a Dalit, you are an untouchable.
You became fascinated early on with the story of your remarkable uncle, Sachamuthi, or SM as he was popularly known. Tell us about SM.
SM was born in those tumultuous years when India was fighting against colonialism. There was Quit India movement. Quit India movement started in 1942 against the British, when the British were in the middle of World War, because they felt that, you know, it's a good time to pressure them to give independence. So he was 13 years old at that time. And actually, when Quit India was going on, he was 11 years old. He participated in it. He joined the Youth Congress. He thought that all the troubles that he was facing and the people like him were facing are due to colonialism. And so he was very fervently, you know, he was a supporter of Congress, and he was active as a young member. But when independence came and nothing changed, so he was disillusioned. And at that time, communists were waging a war against a Muslim prince in the neighboring state, and poor peasants were rebelling against that prince. And so he thought, like, this may be the way to go. So at 16, he became a communist. And then communists also disappointed him. He was disillusioned. And after China became, you know, communist, he was attracted to the Chinese path. And he thought that Chinese way of making a revolution is the way to do it in India. That's what he fought for.
Sujatha, he wanted to lead a revolt. He reached a point where he realized that militancy was the only option. What happened?
Telangana armed revolt was the one that took place in 1942. They were fighting against the Muslim prince, you know, and then they were fighting against a very cruel system of oppression that existed at that time. It's called Vetti. It's sort of a, you know, caste-based slavery. Every untouchable had to give up their eldest son to go as a slave to the landlords. And the women are chattel. They go and work for the landlords. And if the landlord thinks that, you know, she should go and work for his daughter after marriage, so the untouchable women are sent as chattel along with the different furniture and things to go to the daughter's house and be a slave there. So they fought, and they finally recognized that it's we can't fight without weapons. And so poor peasants fought with weapons against the prince and against the Indian army. And that there was a time when they had success for a few months. And that's why my uncle thought that armed revolt is the only way to achieve a revolution.
One of the most shocking things I learnt from your book was that Gandhi and Nehru were not sympathetic to the Dalits at all.
No. For any militant and self-respecting untouchable, Gandhi is a mortal enemy of untouchables. The only reason Gandhi took up upliftment of untouchables is because representation in government depended on majority. And there are Muslims here and Hindus there. And so having untouchables on his side was very important for him. That was the reason that he took up, you know, upliftment of untouchables. But what he wanted was he wanted the caste system to remain, but somehow prettify it, remove some of the ugly aspects of it. And the main thing that he fought for was temple entry. Who cares about temple entry? What does it do for Dalits? They want land. They want equality. They want access to education and jobs. That is none of, you know, it's not there in Gandhi's scheme of things. The main reason was that he wanted Hindu majority and he wanted Dalits to join Hinduism, be on the side of Hinduism. In fact, he was known to say, if we allow them, untouchable hooligans and Muslim hooligans will join forces and kill caste Hindus. That he said, in a private conversation with Patel. That really shows that he was a very casteist. And then secondly, his slogan of Ramarajya. Ramarajya is ideal Hindu society in which all castes must abide by their, dharma. Basically, Ramarajya means that it tells what the place of untouchables is in the society and what the place of women in the society. So calling for Ramarajya means is nothing but, you know, perpetuating caste.
And of course, untouchables also felt betrayed by Nehru, didn't they?
Yes, they did. In Andhra especially, there was disillusionment, sharp disillusionment in Nehru, because Nehru's slogan is, national integrity. What that means is that everybody should be together and nobody should want to separate and have a separate state. India, if you think of it, is a prison house of nations. There are different languages, different cultures, different climates. I cannot understand people from the other states at all. So these people wanted some kind of autonomy, but Nehru stood for national integrity, which is a euphemism for keeping everybody together under the rule of Hindus and Hindi, North Indian Hindus and Hindi language. We hated him.
It's interesting that the constitution in which Dalit leaders played a role in formulating enshrined the notion of equal rights, banned discrimination, but it meant very little in practical terms.
Yes. One of my friends said there are literally thousands of rules and laws against untouchability, but it's amazing how much they're disregarded. Dalits are routinely subjected to violence, and every 5 minutes or 2 minutes, a Dalit woman is raped. Every 5 minutes, there is a Dalit murder. And sometimes they subject the Dalits to social boycott, means that they're just isolated. Nobody sells them groceries. Nobody gives them work. They cannot even use the paths to go outside of the village because it doesn't belong to them. It's just starvation that goes on even now. And it is because the problem of untouchability is they want land. They're not allowed to have land. And there are rules also, laws also, to give land to untouchables. But who's going to implement the rules? Who's going to do, stand on the side of the untouchables? It's the police. And the police are in the hands of the upper caste landlords. There is no use of laws if you cannot implement them.
It's also politically advantageous for a reigning government to apparently offer recognition to Dalits, hence the fact that there's the current president is an untouchable.
Yes.
But this is what? Window dressing?
Yes. Jagjivan Ram, I think he was the one you were talking about when you went to India all those years ago, the untouchable president. I don't know. Some people might have been taken by him, but no Dalit, no untouchable right now believes that it means anything to them. they hate the fact that it's almost like an insult, a slap in the face for untouchables to install this man, an untouchable, as a president. And if you look at photos of Modi and this president in public functions, you could see how badly he's treated. He just looks like a servant standing by. So nobody feels anything will come out of this.
You mentioned earlier that the desire to be admitted to temples. Well, there's let's look at the temple of education. There are reserved places for Dalits at universities, but you point out that many face an astonishing amount of discrimination and that suicide is not uncommon among Dalit students.
Yes. Yeah.
Why? Why are they killing themselves?
Reservations, I must first and foremost say that they should be maintained because they help, even if it is a very tiny, thin layer of Dalits. It should be maintained, and any attack on reservations must be fought against. But reservations have not done anything much for Dalits. You know, reservations means that you have a certain number of seats allotted to Dalits in universities. But going up to the point of university itself is a big, you know, insurmountable thing. They have to have food to be able to go to school. They have to have clothes to be able to go to school. And they cannot spare small children to go to school because the small children also are earning members of the family. So it's a failure. It helped a very thin layer of untouchables. And even those people in their jobs, their position is precarious. And if you somehow do make it into universities, they will harass you until you commit suicide. So that's how it is with reservations.
As indeed your uncle literally starved at uni. But I would imagine that years, centuries, millennia of oppression means that Dalits internalize the prejudice.
Yes.
What effect does this have on people?
Take, for example, my mother. She grew up with a communist brother. She is very rebellious and outspoken when it comes to public and social issues. She would condemn atrocities on untouchables, etc. But in her personal life, she completely compromised with her co-workers, colleagues. They tried. She never tried to think about the cruel behavior that they showed towards her, because there are so many problems like poverty and other things, children's health. She didn't want to have one more thing to feel angry about and to feel, to have to fight for it. We internalize it, and we also think that we should try to be like caste Hindus. If you get some good job, people who get jobs because of reservations, they try to act like Hindus in their customs, and they even take up vegetarianism, and they forget their brothers and sisters who are not as fortunate as them.
The book illustrates clearly how precarious life was for untouchables like your family. As you say, no job security, no secure home, no guarantee of food, no promise of a future. Is anything changing for the better?
During independence struggle and right after independence struggle, it seemed like things were getting better for untouchables. But as I said, in order to fight colonialism, they had to show a united front against the colonists. That is why they invited Dalits into their fold, and they talked about upliftment and this and that. And as soon as they achieved independence, it's over. It's getting worse and worse and worse for untouchables. And in fact, right now is the highest violence against untouchables. They cannot. They were killed for wearing a watch. They were killed for wearing shoes. They also go scot-free. There was a massacre where 11 people were killed by caste Hindus, and the court case went on for 30 years. And in the end, they threw out the case. Untouchables have no safety in India, and especially so under BJP and Modi.
You were recently a guest at the Jaipur Literary Festival, and you found that a lot of Indians had no idea about caste, even though they live with it.
Yes.
How can that be?
It's stunning to me. Actually, I wrote the book, and actually I wrote it for Westerners to describe to them what caste system is. But what stunned me was that a lot of caste Hindus, a lot of non-untouchables, they were, wow, is this what's going on in our, vicinity around us? They just didn't notice, because caste is like air we breathe. Caste is like, water we drink. So they don't even have to think. They don't even think that, oh, we are perpetrating caste discrimination on them. They just do, and they think that it's normal. That's why people don't think that there is caste system.
You live in New York now, and you say that among the Indians you've met there, caste still carries weight.
Yes.
I find that an astonishing concept, that in the diaspora it has still got that sort of tenacity.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, when people who are able to come to America or other European countries are upper caste people, because they have the education to be able to come here. Even the visa office employees discriminate against Dalits, even if they make up to it. So the majority of people who come here are overwhelmingly upper caste people, and they bring their prejudices with them. And they have these immigrant cultural associations ostensibly to, celebrate their culture and their festivals. But in fact, they are caste networks. For example, I come from a region where we speak Telugu. So what is the necessity for five different Telugu cultural associations? It is because one is for the interests of Kamma caste, one is for Kapu caste, and there are some cultural immigrant groups that openly say that this is Telugu Brahmin Association. How would you feel this is white supremacist organization? Would that be allowed? But they're doing that. They have Brahmin caste associations here.
Mm. Most Dalits think of the Dalit parties back in India as unsatisfactory. Why?
First of all, all parliamentary parties have to serve the same kind of classes that exist in society. They cannot veer away from that. So basically, they're all the same. But even if they're not, Dalits don't have electoral majority. They can only give majority by joining Hindus or Muslims. So untouchable parties, they can never have, absolute majority to form government. And so they have to make alliances with Congress. And BSP, which is the main Dalit party in India, the woman, the Chief Minister Mayawati, she made alliance with Modi 9 months after the genocide of Muslims in Gujarat. She went campaigning for Modi. And how is that principled stand for an untouchable party?
We talked earlier about untouchables converting to Christianity. I neglected to ask you, has there ever been an alliance or a process of conversion between Muslims and Dalits?
Actually, I should say that caste system is a social system. It's not a religious institution. It's just that Hinduism codified caste in its, books, whatever it is. But basically, it's a social institution. Therefore, irrespective of religion, caste is practiced. So when Muslims came to India, they automatically fell into castes. There are Dalit Muslims and there are upper caste Muslims. And similar thing with Christianity. There were some Christians who married Portuguese. The upper caste Brahmins married Portuguese. They are upper caste Christians. They have nothing in common with us. So the alliance between Muslims and untouchables is happening right now under Modi because both groups are, you know, they're just getting slaughtered.
Sujatha, it's been marvellous to talk to you. Sujatha Gidler, her book is Ants Among Elephants, An Untouchable Family and the Making of Modern India, and it's published by Farrar Straus. Sujatha, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me at this place.